Today I want to try to cover two different topics if we can. I'm allotted. Each one kind of in short. The first topic is Lag BaOmer, and the second topic is the next mitzvah we're up to in our mitzvah count. But I didn't want to have the week go by and not discuss Lag BaOmer a little bit. So let's discuss Lag BaOmer for a few moments, you know, maybe longer than a few moments, and then we'll get to the next topic if we have time. Just to put it in context, so we've been counting the Omer ever since Pesach, began second day of Pesach. The Omer period we discussed is a time of anticipation for Shavuos. We're waiting to receive the Torah. When the Jews left Egypt, it was done in order to receive the Torah on Mount Sinai. That was the whole goal of the Exodus. So we count the days one by one with anticipation. We can't wait till we get to Shavuos, which is the 50th day after they left Egypt. The period has been overshadowed over the years by certain tragedies which occurred. Most famously, the tragedy of Rabbi Akiva's students passing away. 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva died in a plague during this period of time. And we have mourning practices which exist throughout the time of Sefirot Omer. Such as not getting married, not shaving, etc. These things exist during this time of year. And that's all to remember the death of Rabbi Akiva's 24,000 students. Now there's one day in the middle of the counting of the Omer which has a unique status, Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day. Of the count. Lag meaning Lamed Gimel is 33. Lamed is 30, Gimel is 3, it's 33. That's why it's called Lag BaOmer. The day of Lag BaOmer is actually quite mysterious as to why it's so joyous. There are very few early sources describing the joy of the day. There are later sources, when I say later in Jewish time, later is early for us, but I mean, there's no Talmudic sources, so the sources don't date back to the Talmud, they date later than the Talmud. So we're talking about maybe the 8th, 9th, 10th century, something like that, is our earliest sources, which for history is not so bad, but for Jewish sources is actually pretty late. But there's no Talmudic source for Lag BaOmer being anything of significance. The sources come up later, but the significance of the Omer comes from a few different angles. And one point is that we have a tradition that Rabbi Akiva's students... The plague ceased to kill them on Lag BaOmer. Whether it was a hiatus during the plague, whether it was the end of the plague, that's debatable. But certainly it was a day that the plague did not strike his students. So it means there was some form of joy in Lag BaOmer, being that Rabbi Akiva's students did not die on that day. Which is why we have a pause in our mourning practices. You're allowed to get married Lag BaOmer, you can shave Lag BaOmer, you can listen to music and dance Lag BaOmer, you're allowed to be joyous Lag BaOmer, even though you're mourning for Rabbi Akiva's students, since that day sets itself aside as a unique day and that they didn't die on that day. So that's one source we have for the joy of Lag BaOmer. The next source we have, door locked. Door's locked, I think. We start a new policy. If you're late, then you're out.
Sorry.
Just kidding. Fran, you're always welcome. You know that. You must have been one of our first members of the class, you know, years and years ago. You're always welcome. Yeah, welcome back. So that's one reason for the joy of Lag BaOmer. The second reason, which is, I think, much less known, is that there's a calculation made that in the desert, when the Jews left Egypt, so what did they eat? So they left with matzah initially. And they actually had matzah for 30 days. So we know the famous story, they left with matzah on Pesach night, the day of the Exodus. There's no time for it to become chametz, and they packed up their provisions and went on the road. So tradition tells us that matzah lasted for 30 days. So that brings them to the 15th of the month of Iyar. For 3 days they had no food to eat, and then they complained, and God started bringing down upon them the mud, the manna. That was happened on the 18th of Iyar, and that's the day of Lag BaOmer. So there is a reason to say that Lag BaOmer was the first day that the mud began to fall in the desert. That's a lesser-known joy, Lag BaOmer. But that was a very joyous day because that was the day where the Jews understood how they were going to survive in the desert for all those years. That was when the man started to fall. There's an additional concept, which is very relevant to Shavuos, which is that the Talmud teaches us that the Torah was given to those who eat the man. Meaning it's a true fact. Those who ate man received the Torah. But the Talmud is teaching us there was something unique about being a man eater, which made you appropriate to receive the Torah. And those who actually consume man were the right people, had the right state of mind, state of soul, and state of body to receive the Torah. Now why is that? So there are many reasons for that. But one understanding is that the idea of man, it was a food that, despite the fact that it supported their physical body, it was a very spiritual food. It didn't have much substance, had no waste. They didn't use the bathroom when they ate man. There was no waste in the body. It was all nutrition. Essentially, it was something I would compare it to being on an IV in a certain sense. Like the nutrition got in the body, but there was no actual physical eating. They may put it in their mouths, but it was more of a spiritual experience to eat mud. So and those who had mud, you couldn't have like a feast on it. You had what you had. Everyone got the same amount every single day. You ate it; it was gone. You couldn't save for tomorrow. And it was a very minimalistic type of living, that they had exactly the nutrition they needed, no more, no less. That was what mun was. Those who were able to truly succeed as spiritual Jews and to serve God are people who are not materialistic. They're not big on food, on possessions, on money. And living in the desert on mun was a symbol of that, that you can subsist on the divine, and you don't need more than that. And you can get your thrills and your excitement and your joy not from physical property or money or from food, but from spirituality and from God. That was the symbolism of mun, on one level at least. So God gave us mun and prepared us to receive the Torah, meaning that God made the people, he encouraged them, become more spiritual, eat mun, forget about physical everyday food, forget about accruing wealth. You couldn't save mun. If you saved your mun, it would go rotten. And just focus on serving God. All you need is the basics to survive, and you can focus on the important things in life, which is your spirituality, your service of Hashem. So that's the idea of mun. It's actually interesting. You find in the book of Bamidbar, the Jews started complaining, as they did many times in the Torah. And one of the times they complained, in the book of Bamidbar, this is Parshas Baloscha, is it says that the people, the word used is his Abu Taiba. They lusted a lust. You know, they desired a lust, something like that. That's the translation. And many commentators explain that, you know, sometimes, even if you have nutrition that you need, we want to take a big bite out of a hamburger. We want to feel that, like, we have food to eat. We want to feel like, you know, you want to grab onto it, you want to eat it, you want to get involved in the food. And, you know, if someone told me once, you know, they're on an IV, and even though you're hungry, but you still feel something lacking because you have the nutrition, but you didn't get to sit down to a meal, and that experience is gone. So the Jews in the desert, some could handle that lifestyle and said, we need to have physical desire. We need to have something physical to sink our teeth into. And they complained, and then that's, you know, God sent the plague, and they sent the quails to eat. You know, that was one of the stories there. But the idea is that Kazman was a spiritual eating experience. It wasn't a physical eating experience. So ideally, the one who is most suited to serve God is one who's risen above the fray of physicality, and they get their energy and their excitement through Torah, through learning Torah, through doing mitzvot, through helping others, and that's where the excitement of life comes from. Some of us are not quite on that level. We need to stick our teeth into a hot dog sometimes. You know, some of us need that. But mun is significant. So Lag BaOmer, the day that mun began to fall, is one of the first days kind of looking forward to Shavuos now. Like we're in the final stretch of the count of the Omer. Shavuos is about 2 weeks from now, 2.5 weeks, and we really look forward to receiving the Torah on Shavuos, and therefore we start preparing by trying to cast off some physicality and focus on spirituality. So the mun is that symbol. We're trying to, you know, kind of cut back on physical pleasure, physical desires in terms of sinking our teeth into food and focusing on that spiritual food called mun. So that's one of the significant points about Lag BaOmer. But perhaps the point about Lag BaOmer, which has become most prominent, you know, and creates most of the hoopla and excitement on the day, is the third point. And that is the story and the death of the great leader and teacher, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was one of the great Tanayim, a great rabbi in the period of the Mishnah. He was one of Rabbi Akiva's five students that he had after the plague. I mean, Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students that died. That's what we mourn for in this period. The Talmud relates that after all his students died, he picked himself up, dusted himself off, and he went down and found five more students. So he went south and found five more students. And these students all became really our leaders and the pillars of Torah for the rest of history. And one of these students was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon was somebody who is looked at as the pillar of Kabbalah, of the mystical parts of Torah. He's the author of the Zohar. Zohar is for us the basis of all Kabbalistic thought. And for us, he's really a pillar of inspiration as in terms of the heights a person can reach in spirituality in this world. So his day of death, his yortzeit, was Lag BaOmer. His birthday is also Lag BaOmer. We know that there's a concept that righteous people, they born and die on the same day because they complete their years. So some say his birthday is also Lag BaOmer. And a lot of the joy and excitement of Lag BaOmer corresponds to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's life experiences and yortzeit. Now, many of us are thinking, well, why is a yortzeit a Jewish day? Yortzeit's a sad day. You know, when we have a yortzeit of a loved one, it's a sad day typically. And the answer is, it's a bittersweet day. Because on one hand, you know, you're sad you miss the person. On the other hand, you celebrate someone's accomplishments. When somebody has passed on, you can look back at their life and say, look how much they've done. And when a great person passes on, we actually celebrate the yortzeit. Especially when Hasidic Jews, actually, they'll make a holiday out of a yortzeit of their rebbes. And the reason being, because this person was in the world, they accomplished so much, left behind an amazing legacy, and we can celebrate their legacy. So it's true with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai as well. We're celebrating, like Omer, his legacy, what he's left in our world, the impact he made. And the impact he made is the tremendous depth of Torah mysticism, which we have, of Kabbalah, of Zohar, that's all traced back to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's work and his teachings. There's a common custom to light bonfires in Lag BaOmer. And those bonfires, the idea of bonfires is associated with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's yortzeit. In a sense, it's his yortzeit candle. That's kind of what you look at it as. His yortzeit candle, these bonfires. So when we have a yortzeit of a loved one, we light a little candle. So for him, we have these bonfires. You go to Israel, Lag BaOmer, and you look in the horizon, you see fires everywhere. You seen that before? Yeah. It's an amazing experience. You know, in Yerushalayim, look towards Har Nof, or back of the other mountain, and you can see these fires all over the place. Yeah?
Do you have Hilulot among Ashkenaz? Do you celebrate Hilulot?
Not like Sephardim do.
We have Hilulot.
Right.
At my Gendavim.
Right. So, I mean...
It's a joyous event.
Yeah, so Lag BaOmer is really the only Hilula that Ashkenazim typically will recognize. You know?
You don't have Hilula?
Typically not, no. It's not the Ashkenazi custom. Right. Well, the Hilula is the bonfire and the celebration of the bonfire. I'm saying I think Sephardim have Hilula more often than just Lag BaOmer. They do that for many, many yortzeits, which Ashkenazic Jews typically do not. But that's the idea. And the bonfire also represents Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's teachings. Because his teachings of Kabbalah, of mysticism, it represents the more abstract, higher end of Torah. Meaning that a lot of Torah is very, very tangible. You know, I need to know, is my bottle of tea kosher or not kosher? It's tea and it's in a glass bottle and I can make a bracha on it. This is a very physical part of Torah. We talk about mysticism and Kabbalah, this is a very conceptual, abstract part of Torah. And it's something which is similar to a fire. A fire is something which you see it, you can't touch it. You know, there's no substance to it when you put your hand inside, you get burnt, but you don't feel anything there. And it's always reaching upward, higher. It's reaching up to the heavens, as it were. So the fire represents this kind of Torah. It's a Torah which is directed towards the heavens. It's very mystical. And it's something which is much more ethereal and conceptual. So that portion of Torah is compared to fire. And that's one of the ideas of lighting the fires on Lag BaOmer. So the day of his death, Rabbi Shimon actually revealed many of the secrets of Kabbalah on the day of his death. It's recorded in the Zohar. The day he died, he told his students, you know, get out your pens and write these lessons down. And much of what we have in the Zohar came on the day of his death. Before he died, he taught all these secrets to his students, and then he passed on. So we celebrate his accomplishments. The accomplishments of the work of the Zohar, the accomplishments of becoming the pillar of this area of Torah, in our inspiration, in spirituality, that's what we celebrate on that day. The rabbis even teach us that the sun didn't set the day that he died until he died, meaning the day extended longer and longer and longer until he passed on. So lighting the fire on Lag BaOmer night also symbolizes that. The sun keeps on shining on the day of Lag BaOmer. There is a famous custom that to play with a bow and arrow on Lag BaOmer. Nowadays, a lot of schools will have a field day on Lag BaOmer. The kids will play outside in the fields. But there's an old custom of kids playing with bows and arrows on Lag BaOmer. Where does this come from? So many explanations given. But one explanation given is that we know a rainbow, similar to a bow and arrow, a rainbow is a bad sign in Jewish thought. A rainbow is the sign that God gave to Noah after the flood, saying that I won't destroy the world again. When you see a rainbow, the sign is that even though the world may deserve destruction, God has a covenant with mankind that I can't destroy the world anymore. So a rainbow is actually a bad sign. You're not supposed to tell somebody to see a rainbow because it's like you're spreading bad news. So you see a rainbow, that's actually a blessing to make. You make the bracha on it. The bracha, the idea of the bracha is that God sticks to his word, doesn't destroy us. That's the bracha, which you can look at your siddur and find the bracha. And you're not supposed to share it with anybody. You're supposed to just look at it, make your bracha, and move on. Because as beautiful as a rainbow is, it's actually considered a negative sign in Torah thought. But the Talmud tells us that in the days of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, in his lifetime, a rainbow was never seen. Because of his tremendous righteousness, a tremendous merit, the world never actually reached that point where it deserved destruction. So in his whole lifetime, a rainbow was never actually displayed in the world, and therefore, playing with the bow in Lag BaOmer is supposed to be reminiscent of the rainbow. That's why it's a bow. And we're trying to remember Rabbi Shimon's righteousness to show that, I guess now we have bows, but his days there are no bows along those lines. So that's one reason to play with a bow and arrow on Lag BaOmer. There is one more, just there's a very famous story, which really shows us where Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai developed his greatness and how great he was. And I'm going to share the story with you. It's just worthwhile knowing if you haven't heard the story before. It's a story later in the Talmud. It's in Tractate Shabbos. And it speaks about Rabbi Shimon, you know, basically where Rabbi Shimon developed his greatness. There's actually a piyut, you know, liturgical poem, which is said, Svardim say it weekly, every Friday night. If you go to a Svardi house on Friday night, typically they'll say a piyut called Bar Yochai. It's a song sung in honor of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. They say it every Friday night. Ashkenazim say Lag BaOmer. That's about the only time we'll say it. Many Sephardic Jews say this poem every single Friday night. And relates Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's greatness. It speaks about who he was and how great he was. In that poem, it says that it speaks about a period of time he spent inside a cave. And it says in the poem that in the cave is where he acquired his honor, his greatness. It was acquired inside a cave. So what cave are we talking about? So the Gemara tells us that there were three great sages who were sitting around and talking about the Romans. Why they're doing that, I'm not sure. They're talking about the Romans. And it says that Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon were talking about the Romans. So Rabbi Yehuda said, look how beautiful are the actions of this nation, of the Romans. They made beautiful marketplaces, they made beautiful bridges and beautiful bathhouses. What a wonderful nation to have ruling over the land of Israel. Rabbi Yossi didn't respond to that. He remained silent. Rabbi Shimon said, what are you talking about? He said, whatever they did it for themselves. They made these marketplaces in order so prostitutes can have business in the marketplaces. And they made bathhouses in order to take care of themselves, and they made bridges in order to charge lots of tax. So they're not such great people. So there was this gentleman, his name was Yehuda ben Gerim. It sounds like he was a Jew who descended from converts. And he wasn't a very nice guy. And he went and he told the Romans what was said about them. And he relayed the story to the Roman government. So the Romans said, oh, Rabbi Yehuda, who spoke highly of us, we're going to give him great honor. Rabbi Yossi, who didn't say anything, remained silent, we're going to exile him. And Rabbi Shimon, we have to execute, because he spoke negatively about the Romans. So Rabbi Shimon gets word of this, and he flees. First he hid for a while inside, I think, the local shul. But after a while, he thought that they were going to blow his cover. So he went off to a cave. He ran to a cave, and he and his son together. He had a son named Rabbi Elazar. So Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon went off to a cave. And it says that while they were in the cave, a miracle happened, and God sprouted in the cave a carob tree and a spring of water. So they're inside the cave, and all they had to eat was carobs and water, based on a miracle from God. And they spent, I think it was 12 years inside the cave, 12 years in the cave. Hiding from the Romans. Now it says while they're in the cave, what they would do is that they didn't want their clothes to wear out. So they took off their clothes and they buried themselves in sand until their necks all day long in the cave while they were learning Torah. And they learned Torah together in the cave all day long. When it was time to say Shema, they put their clothes on in the honor of Shema. They actually were exempt. It's very interesting that there is a halacha that somebody who is engaged in Torah study nonstop is exempt from davening. You don't have to pray. So they're exempt from actually going to say davening from Shemon Esrei, but they had to say Shema, because Shema is a Torah obligation. So when it came time to say Shema, they put their clothes back on and say Shema, and then they take off their clothes and go back in the sand again. But they're preserving those clothes just in order to be able to have them to say Shema, and to honor God. And they said Shema. So they spent 12 years in the cave studying together, and it was in that cave that we say Rabbi Shimon developed his greatness. If you can imagine the dedication they had to Torah. They had nothing else in life. All they had was each other and words of Torah. And for 12 years they lived on bare minimum carobs and water, miraculous carobs and water, and studied Torah nonstop. At a certain point, 12 years later, it says that Elijah the prophet, came to the door of the cave, and he went to let them know that the Caesar had died, and nobody is going to kill them anymore. So they were free to leave the cave. So that's how they left the cave. Now they came out of the cave, and they were on such a high spiritual level, they really could not understand anyone involved in physicality. So the story goes, they left the cave, and they saw somebody plowing his field. And they said, How could somebody put aside the spiritual world and involve themselves in the physical world? And they were so charged spirituality, wherever they looked, fire would just spread. They'd be shooting out fire from themselves. They were at such a high level. So a heavenly voice came out and said, get back in the cave. You know, you're not ready to come out of the cave. You're going to destroy my world. So God sent them back into the cave again for another year. So they went to the cave for another year. They said, well, wicked people suffer in Gehenna, in hell, for 12 months. That's our tradition. So we're going to go back in the cave for 12 months. So then they left the cave again, and they came out, and they kind of understood how to live in the world once again, and they were able to enter into the world, etc. And the story goes on with some other interesting points. That's the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave. So for 13 years, essentially, he studied Torah in a cave nonstop with nothing of physicality, no food, no drink, no anything besides his son and Torah study. And it's in that cave where he was able to develop himself to be such a pillar of spirituality, such a great Torah scholar, and the source of all Kabbalistic thought that we have. Yeah?
This cave is located in Eretz Yisrael?
Yes. I don't know where the cave is, but yeah, it's in Eretz Yisrael. That's where it was.
We know that?
Yeah, we know that. I don't know which cave it was, but we know it was in Eretz Yisrael. That much we know. So that was who he was. So and during that experience, he became such a spiritual person. He was able to understand really the such secrets of spirituality of creation. And that's the idea of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. So Lag BaOmer, a major chunk of it, a major part of the celebration, it revolves around Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's yahrzeit. For those who have been, his tomb in Eretz, you've been there? I've never been there. I've seen pictures. His tomb is in Israel, in the city of Meron. And Lag BaOmer becomes major, major events. I mean, tens of thousands of people make a pilgrimage to his tomb in Lag BaOmer. And there's, you know, fires, and I mean, you can tell more than I can, but there's just a celebration and music and fires and food and drink and everything. It's just this major, major event at Rabbi Shimon's tomb. It's essentially Heilula. That's just the other word to call it. But yeah.
On the 33rd day?
Yeah, the 33rd day of life. Yeah.
Tomorrow?
Yeah, on Wednesday. Tomorrow. Well, on Wednesday night. Tomorrow night, really. Tomorrow night.
Is there a book or a link that combines the secrets found by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai?
I mean, the book is the Zohar. That's his book. But
has anybody listed for people like me and you?
Well, I mean, there are writings which kind of simplify.
Clear English words.
Yes and no. I mean, there are writings that simplify Kabbalistic thought. Many books, many writings are like that, which are very much available. Maybe I'll take a second just to discuss that question, because it's an important question. And we talk about the idea of Kabbalah, mysticism. What do we mean by that exactly? You know, I think it's a very misused, misunderstood term. People don't understand what it means. You know, you have these movie stars who study Kabbalah, apparently, and you know.
String around the wrist.
Yeah, you have all these things also. So when we say that he was the one who was the pillar of Kabbalistic thought, what does that mean exactly? What is Kabbalah? We divide Torah into four different sections, essentially. It's called, the acronym is in Hebrew is Pardes. Pshat, Remez, Drush, Sod. Which means, Pshat means this, the simple understanding. And every single verse has a simple understanding. So it says, God spoke to Moses saying, that means God spoke to Moses. That's what it means. You know, and it says, you should put on tefillin, you put on tefillin. That's the simple understanding. That's the first level. There's another level, which we refer to as drush, which means we're going to expound upon the verse. You know, there's an extra letter here, which teaches you a new halacha. There's an extra word there, teaches you a lesson about something else. That's the expounding upon it. There's a level called remez, which means a hint, an allusion, an A, which means that every single verse may actually symbolize some other concept as well. Such an example offhand. You know, we know there's a concept that the actions of the patriarchs are considered a symbol for the children. That's a famous concept that commentaries have. So when you see Abraham or Yaakov doing something, they're doing it, but it's also symbolic of what will happen in the future. So there's a level of that which is a hint towards something else. And then there's a level called sod, we refer to as secret, a secret level.
Is this the level of Gematria?
Gematria is more of the remez level, the
third
level, yeah. Sod, that's what we would call Kabbalah, mysticism, the secret level. So what does that mean exactly? It's not a secret. I mean, we're telling secrets. It doesn't mean that, like, it's a secret. It means that there's another level of understanding, which is something that it's not really within our world. It's a spiritual analogy, for instance. So, like, for instance, Kabbalistic thought essentially is the mechanics of how God runs the world. How does God take his tremendous goodness and influence and bring it down into the physical world? That's really the sum total of Kabbalistic thought. The analogy would be, you know, the power plant has a lot of power built in, you know, and you can have a nuclear explosion there, God forbid. It goes through a series of different mechanisms which kind of filter the power out so that you can plug in your blender in your house and you don't explode, you know. If you plug your blender into the reactor, probably everything would explode, I guess. I don't know. But so same thing, you know, God is like this nuclear reactor. God is this big power plant. And he wants to give us life and goodness that has to make it to our world somehow. So it goes through a series of spiritual, it filters it out and it tones it down so that it can reach our world. And Kabbalah, in its essence, is describing how does God interact with our world? How does God, which is infinite and powerful and spiritual, influence our world? Another way, how do our actions influence spiritual realms? It goes both ways. So when we pray, when we observe Shabbos, when we take a lulav, what does that do to the spiritual realm? So we have a level of, keeping Shabbos, we're remembering the fact that God rested on the seventh day. But there's another level of Shabbos, which when I keep Shabbos, I'm doing all sorts of things in the spiritual world, which are going to bring blessing to our world and impact things in the future and currently and in the past and everything else. I can't measure that within any scientific equation. I can't take a ruler and see what I did. But in the spiritual realm, something happened. So Kabbalistic thought tells us, you know, what happens when I do X? How does it impact the world? So how does it impact the spiritual realm? That's essentially, it's really the mechanics of how spirituality and physicality interact. That's what Kabbalah is. So there's a verse in the Torah which describes something. It has its simple level, but also a level that says, you know, Abraham is not just a person, he's also a concept. He represents a spiritual concept. And when Abraham does X, that means that spiritual concept up in the spiritual world is doing X as well, whatever the X is. You know, that's Kabbalistic thought. The challenge of Kabbalistic thought is that if somebody doesn't understand it correctly, it'd be heretical. Now, if you take the concepts and you understand them too superficially, then you're misunderstanding God. And that's why Kabbalah is reserved for those who are prepared for it. Now, Kabbalah is something traditionally you should be 40 years old at least to learn Kabbalah and be well-versed in Torah overall. Because if you're somebody who just jumps right in, then you're not going to understand it right. The idea of it being a secret is not because we're keeping it secret. It's because if you're not ready for it, you're not going to get it. So it just automatically remains a secret. You know, it's like, you know, Einstein could get up and teach us an equation. So if I'm ready for it, then I'll say, wow, that's an incredible equation. If I'm not, either it's meaningless to me or I'll misunderstand it and I'll blow something up. That's what will happen. So it's this, if you're ready for it, if you've been studying physics for 50 years and you're very intelligent and you can slowly understand the terminologies and the concepts Einstein's trying to relate to us, then you can understand his point. But if not, it remains secret from you, not because he kept it secret, because you can't get it. That's the.
So since we are ready, can you start teaching us Kabbalah next year?
Well, you're assuming I know it, and you're assuming that we're ready. We have to figure out both of those.
Can we try?
We try. I mean, you know, it's a...
basic.
I think there's so many basics to go through before that point, you know? I mean, there are things we've mentioned in the class over the years that do relate to Kabbalistic concepts. And maybe I should point them out more often if I speak about one. But the idea is that, you know, it's something people will pick up on. And it even says, you know, the Mishnah relates. They're not really supposed to teach Kabbalah openly. They're supposed to kind of give over the general points to deserving students. And if they get it, they get it. If they don't, they don't. That's what makes it a secret. Not because anybody is saying, hush, hush, don't tell anybody. It's more that you have to, if a person doesn't get it, they won't get it or they'll misunderstand it. That's the idea of that whole portion of Torah. So the Zohar is square one of any Kabbalistic thought, of Shem Bar Yochai's work. There are many, many early commentaries. Most of them did not write all that much. You know, in the Rishonim period, basically moving from the Talmudic times all the way through the Arizal, who lived, I think, in the 1500s, there's very little written. There are a few books here and there about Kabbalistic thought. It was kind of kept just like oral, Rebbe to student, etc. The one who really brought it out in modern times was Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, the famous Arizal, who lived in the city of Tzfat in Israel. He had many students, and he taught what we would call, I guess, the modern revelation of Kabbalah came through him. he took all these different secrets and principles of Rav Shem Bar Yochai and he related them in different words and taught them to students who spread the word. That was kind of the next stage of Kabbalah. And then after that, so there are many works we have from his students. And then really the Hasidic world, they kind of took the Kabbalistic ideas and made them more down-to-earth, more palatable for the typical, you know, everyday layman. So most Hasidic thought actually is based on Kabbalistic ideas, whether it be, you know, works of the Chabad rabbis or, you know, the Gera Rebbe, the Sfas Emes, many of the Hasidic works of his masters, all of their writings were based on Kabbalistic thought that kind of translated into more down-to-earth terms. And that was kind of, so nowadays, the Kabbalah works are available. Now, the warning I would give is that there are many ones which are authentic, which are not authentic. You have to know who is the one who's actually writing the book and where is he coming from. Is he somebody who has the proper tradition and fears God and puts things out in the proper way? Or is somebody trying to make a quick buck because they're in style to sell Kabbalah books? You know, that's the question, because it's in style now. There are many celebrities have started learning Kabbalah, which I would assume most of it's probably...
Madonna's
the famous one, right? Much of what they're learning, I don't know what they're learning, but I would assume is probably the unauthentic type, you know, because somebody who is not Torah knowledgeable, not Jewish, and not at all observant of Torah law, it's very unlikely they could really understand and tap into true Kabbalah. So I assume most of what's out there is not authentic. There are books written, and one of the great speakers who ties a lot of these ideas in is Rabbi Tatz, Rabbi Akiva Tatz. Have you heard of him before? He's a very famous speaker. He's extremely intelligent. He's South African originally. Akiva, A-K-I-V-A, Tatz, T-A-T-Z. V-A, T-A-T-Z. There's many, many lectures available online of his. There's many books he wrote. And he's somebody who takes a lot of the Kabbalistic thought and relates it over in ways that even the layman can understand. He's someone who is very authentic and very real and very reliable. And there are others like him as well. But he's somebody I would point to as someone who has related these concepts. There are books also, you know, Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan, who was a prolific writer. He died very young. He died, like, I think, in his early 40s or something. Aryeh Kaplan.
A-R-Y-E-H.
Y-E-H?
Sorry,
Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N.
Rabbi also?
Rabbi, yeah. So he was somebody who also was a genius. He, in his lifetime, even though he died very young, wrote, I don't know, dozens of books. And many of them based in Kabbalistic thought on all topics. I mean, he has his books really cover the spectrum. And his works are also readily available. They come, you can buy different individual books, you can buy it in anthologies, but he has lots of books out there. And that's also a good place to look for authentic Kabbalistic concepts, you know, brought down in regular, everyday human terms. He's someone who...
Someone mentioned one of his close friends, Abraham Sutton, Rabbi Sutton.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a compilation of his work. And then Rabbi Sutton now has come out with books as
Books.
Well.
Okay.
That
right.
are really wonderful, like spiritual technology and all these really neat things.
Right. And then there's also a lot of like Hasidic works that are translated into English now. You can find Sfas Emes in English, which also is based on a lot of Kabbalistic ideas. You can find Shem and Mishmuel, which is from a certain Hasidic Rebbe also that has many of these ideas in it. All these are all written in English now and translated well. So these are authentic ways in which I think we can tap into the concepts, you know, on our level. To pick up a Zohar and read, I would not recommend, you know. You know, the only way to do it is, number one, having a lot of backgrounds in Torah and Talmud in general, and to take one passage and to, you can't just read it, you have to really understand what's the metaphor, chew over it, what's it getting at. It's not an easy way. You need a true teacher who's able to bring that out and teach it to you. Most people do not sit down and just read through the Zohar. That's not really done. Usually you find other works that have already chewed it over and has understood it, and they pass on the ideas. And the other part of Kabbalah, people think of Kabbalistic Kabbalah people as like, you know, doing magical miracles and like, you know, these red strings and this and that. So, I mean, there is a concept that somebody who is well versed in Kabbalah is able to tap into the spiritual realm, which means that, as I mentioned last week, how some people out there could read mezuzahs. And when you read a mezuzah, you can find out about the people living in the house. And that's a true concept. There are ideas of, you know, there are different people, mikubalim, out there, kabbalists out there, that do claim that they can understand a person, read them, predict the future about them, which, you know, some are authentic and some are not. You have to know who you're talking about. Because once you're in tune with the spiritual realm and how the mechanics work, you can see a lot more beyond what meets the eye. Most people, especially since, you know, going off on other topics here, but since the times of Shabtai Tzvi, who was the false Messiah, who really, he brought, you know, a terrible depression upon the Jewish world in the 1600s, he used a lot of Kabbalistic ideas to perform miracles and convince others of his credibility. And when he failed and converted to Islam, everybody became very weary of practical usage of Kabbalah. And ever since his time, you find very little practical usage of Kabbalistic ideas, even though somebody who is a Kabbalist should be able to use them and actually perform miracles with it, but people don't. And if someone claims to, you have to think twice about who the person is, because most of the great sages in the Jewish world have shied away from that since Shabtai Tzvi's times. Many of the great controversies which have happened since then, certainly in Eastern Europe, were over, are you a follower of Shabtai Tzvi, and are you trying to use too many Kabbalistic ideas in your writings and in your life or not? So that was something which was a great source of contention after his times. Before his times, people did use these things here and there, Kabbalistic, you know, incantations and things like that, in order to perform miracles. But since his times, the whole world, certainly the Ashkenazic world, even the Sephardic world, has shied away from it, you know, almost totally, from using practical Kabbalistic concepts. The idea of, let's say, the red string, I'm not sure what the sources of that, you know, I don't know. But just because someone gives you red string doesn't make the person into any sort of Kabbalist, for sure. You know? I mean, the Torah does have ideas of different amulets curing diseases. That's quoted in the Talmud, and that's something, if you're aware of how these things work, you can make it happen. There might be people out there, even to this very day, who might write you an amulet. Again, it might be authentic, it might not be authentic. You have to know who the person is and where they're coming from. There are authentic Kabbalists out there, you know. They're few and far between, but they're authentic ones. But you have to be very weary. If someone comes into town and says, I'm a Kabbalist, let me tell you your future, I would think twice before consulting them. If you call references and your rabbi says he's authentic and this and that, so then you can trust him. But before that, I wouldn't just trust. Many people do come around. It's a business these days. They'll come around and say, give me $20 as a donation, and I'll tell you about your future, and I'll help you find a suitable marriage partner, and they'll help you have children, this and that. And many of them are garbage, and they're just, you know, they're con artists. Many of them are real. You just have to know who you're talking about. Yeah.
To which level following belongs? Berik Esh, covenant of fire, all letters in the word Bereshit. Fir Shabbat, Yirah Shabbat, all letters in Bereshit. Is it the third or the fourth level?
I think it's the third level.
Only the third.
Those are allusions in the word to other concepts as well. But that's not
give me an example of the fourth level.
So that's what I was saying before. Like, for instance, you know, Abraham, he was a human being.
What?
Abraham was a human being. He lived, he died. Everything the Torah says about him actually is history. On the other hand, Abraham represents for us God's attribute of chesed, of kindness. And when you read about Abraham, on a Kabbalistic level, you're reading about God's attribute of kindness and how God's attribute of kindness interacts with the world and this and that. So it's not just an allusion to something practical in our world. It's actually a whole connection to a way that God interacts with the world. And that's, you know, that's the level that you'd find, the Kabbalistic level. Okay, so that's the idea of Kabbalah. I think it's just misunderstood these days. A lot of people misunderstand the concept of Kabbalah in general. And it's been in the world, because it's become so popular in pop culture, it's even more misunderstood and trampled upon. So to understand Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai spent 13 years in the sand with no food studying Torah. That's what it takes to be somebody who truly can understand the mysticism and the depth of the world. For somebody to sit around and, you know, you have a beer and you learn a little Kabbalah and you watch a TV show, it's very hard to believe anybody like that is getting into the depths of God's understanding and God's knowledge in this world. Somebody who's dedicated through and through to God and to Torah, that person eventually will be privy to understanding deeper and deeper secrets of the world. And we can all hope that as life goes on and we become better Jews and better people and devote ourselves more to God, that we have deeper understandings. And that's essentially what Kabbalah is. But you can't read it in a book necessarily. You can have ideas of it in the book, but you can't become somebody who's truly understanding the depth of the ideas through reading a book. It doesn't work that way. It has to be somebody who's worked on his or herself for a lifetime, has a teacher who can pass on the secrets, and is so devoted to the fear of God and the service of God that you can kind of plumb through into the depths of spirituality and look beyond the physical world. And again, Rabbi Shimon is the one who is our model, that 13 years in a cave, you know, most of us couldn't handle a day in a cave like that, you know? So 13 years is quite a long time. And that's where it says in the song, Bar Yochai, in the cave is where he was able to acquire his honor, his glow, his depth of spirituality. So the I guess we're on time for the other topic today. But there's two more quick points. The Lag BaOmer, Lamed Gimel, 33rd day. So also relates to, if you reverse the letters, Lag is Gal. Gal. Lag, Gal. The word Gal means to reveal. And there's a verse that says, Gal and I, open up my eyes, reveal my eyes, and I will see wonders from your Torah. Because Lag BaOmer, in conjunction with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, is a day that we're supposed to be revealed, is revealed to us, the depths and wonders of God's Torah. So it's the day, it's the 33rd day, it's Gal, it's a day of revelations. And it's a day where, just like we know in Shavuos, God revealed to us the written Torah. So Lag BaOmer is a day where God revealed to us the spirituality, the depths and the mysticism of the Torah. That's Lag BaOmer. As one other point is that the number 49, which is the days of the counting of the Omer, is the gematria of Lev Tov, a good heart. The word Lev is 32, Tov is 17. So that means that on the first 32 days, you've finished up the Lev part. You know, we've developed our hearts, and now it's time to look forward to the Tov. The last 17 days, Lag BaOmer and onwards, are the days of Tov, of goodness. And that's 17. So now we're entering into our final 17 days for Shavuos, and this is the time to focus on the goodness of the heart. You know, on being good people, the goodness of the heart. And in that way, we'll merit receiving the Torah on Shavuos, which also is called Tov. The Torah is referred to as Tov as well, as goodness, because the Torah is absolute goodness. So that's the idea. So I guess we'll get next week. We'll get to our other topic. Yeah.
The idea that you should